When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And this week on the show, grab your wide lapel shirts and ridiculous chain wallets for a trip to mid-90s Hollywood and our 20th anniversary review of Swingers.
Inspired by Swingers, we thought, let's take a break from our usual format and just do an hour-long consideration of the late 90s swing music revival. Allison, I love your Cherry Poppin' Daddy shirt.
Oh, thank you, Matt. I'm impressed your Royal Crown Review hoodie still fits after all these years.
Yeah, thanks. I don't remember any other swing bands.
Not Big Bad Voodoo Daddy?
Oh, yeah. They're in the movie.
Brian Setzer Orchestra?
I mean, that sounds familiar.
Squirrel Nut Zippers?
Wow. You actually know a lot of swing.
Big Rude Jake?
Okay, you can stop now.
Johnny Favorite Swing Orchestra?
Are you making these up?
James B. and the Royal Jelly Orchestra?
Please stop.
Not until you tell people what we're really talking about this week.
Okay, all right, fine. We're going to do an episode centered around the films of the Halcyon days of 1996. But first up, it's Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with Movies on Demand on cable, in which we spotlight three titles that are new on demand. Allison, what have you got for us this time?
Well, first up, we have a movie that I've been looking forward to for a while. I missed when it was in theaters, and I am glad that it's now on demand. It is The Clan. This is an Argentine film from Pablo Trapero, not to be confused with The Club, the Chilean film from Pablo Larraín that also came out last year.
I'm glad you clarified, because I thought you were talking about that movie. So
yes.
Go ahead.
They came out like around the same time. They're on the same festival circuit, even.
I saw The Club. I did not see The Clan,
right.
So
well,
I want to hear what
this
it's about.
This is one that is based on the Puccio family, a family from Buenos Aires that actually did kidnap four people, hold them for ransom, and kill three of them in the 80s. And it was a big hit in, you know, Argentina. It was, I think, a fairly successful export. And it also kind of famously juxtaposed very dark subject matter with bright pop songs from the 80s.
Okay.
I do love a good dark movie set to bright music. And it's, you know, gotten very well reviewed. So that's The Clan. It is available now on demand, as are these next two films. First up, Songs My Brothers Taught Me, written and directed by Chloe Zhao. It is her directorial debut and takes place on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, which is where the Lakota Indian, there's a Lakota tribe there. And it's about two siblings who are living fairly difficult lives on this reservation that has been ravaged by alcoholism and poverty. In particular, there's the older brother, who is one of 25 children who have been fathered by a bull rider with nine different mothers, and has all of these kind of half-siblings around who has maybe not that much in common with them until their father dies, and he kind of has to reckon with that. And then his sister has her own journey. It's a really beautifully made film, and I think kind of offers a peek into an area that doesn't get put on screen very often. So that's Songs My Brothers Taught Me. And also new on demand is this year's version of The Boy Next Door, the J-Lo instant classic in which she has a affair with a younger man. In this case, it is about the younger man played by Nick Jonas in his film debut.
What?
It is Careful What You Wish For, an erotic thriller that has basically dumped into theaters.
You had me at erotic thriller and Nick Jonas.
Right. Nick Jonas actually has a more promising dramatic role in the movie Goat, which is like about hazing in a frat, and which played at Sundance and is coming out later this year. It's funny that that movie kind of premiered first, and then this movie, his feature film debut, came out afterwards and is being touted as his first movie. But he plays a high school student who has an affair with the older housewife next door, played by Isabel Lucas, a ripe 31 years old.
Oh, no.
She has an abusive husband, played by Dermot Mulroney. He dies. There is intrigue, etc., etc. I'll be honest, I will totally watch this movie because it sounds ridiculous. But there you go. Also, and do look for Goat. It's a movie that I didn't love, but does feature some very strong performances from Jonas and from the actor who plays his brother. So that is Careful What You Wish For, and it is also now available on demand.
Listen to me, Mike. Your self-esteem is low right now because she's with somebody else. But talking about it and thinking about it all the time, it's depressing. It's no good, man.
You just need a little more time.
Why, so you can sit around your stuffy apartment beating yourself up over it? Remember the first week after she told you?
Don't remind me.
Huh? Couldn't even leave your place. You know, you just sat around your stuffy apartment, sitting there, drinking orange juice, feeling sorry for yourself. Now look at you, man, right? I mean, you got a part in a movie.
Day.
Whatever, Mike, it's work. You understand? You're doing what you love to do. What the hell is she doing now?
Selling scrap metal.
Okay. And this guy she's seeing, what the hell does he do? What?
I heard he drives a carriage around Central Park.
Oh, Mike, please. You're the fun-loving, outgoing party guy, and you're sweating some lawn jockey.
All right, it's time for this week's Listener's Choice Review. On our last show, we gave you three options from 1996, which, to my great astonishment and complete disgust, is now 20 years ago. Allison, 1996 feels like it happened to me, I don't know, 18 months ago?
Yes, and yeah, I think when you watch some of these movies, you're like, oh yes,
yes,
that was a while ago.
Yes. Behold the ravages of age. This is a very poor way of saying that Doug Liman's Swingers was your Listener's Choice winner. It beat out Cameron Crowe's Jerry Maguire. And that year's Best Picture winner, The English Patient, which did put on a strong showing and kind of came back at the last minute, but couldn't quite catch Swingers. Our hero in the film is Michael, played by the film's writer, Jon Favreau, who is a struggling stand-up comic who still hasn't gotten over his breakup to his longtime girlfriend 6 months earlier. His best friend, Trent, played by Vince Vaughn, tries to lift his spirits by dragging him to Las Vegas and an endless string of Hollywood parties and hookup spots, but Mopey Mikey just can't get out of his own head. Swingers was one of the iconic indie movies of its era. It made stars of Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn, and it launched Doug Liman's directorial career as well. It's well remembered for its dialogue, a lot of which has gone on to become part of the vernacular. And may I say, Allison, you are so legal tender, you aren't even aware of it. I'm pretty sure that's how that went, right?
That's definitely how, that's the thing that people say all the time.
Wonderful, wonderful. The opening credits of Swingers play to the sounds of Dean Martin's You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You, which is an appropriate sentiment for the film. And it's an appropriate sentiment for our discussion, particularly the line, "The world still is the same, you'll never change it." Allison,
yes.
20 years later,
yeah.
Is Swingers still the same? You can't change the movie, but has your view of it changed? And after 20 years, how does it hold up?
Yeah, I didn't like it as much. I've seen this movie many times, but I think not for at least a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that you have that feeling. You both remember it very well,
mm-hmm.
and yet
there are things you don't remember.
Well, the context, I think, just like putting it back into another context. And I feel like the things that I still like a lot are, I like the friendship between Mike and Trent. You know, I think that there's something very sweet about it, given all that, like, it is essentially about someone constantly goading their friend into trying to pick up women.
Right.
There's a real sweetness to it that I really like. And I love the scenes in which they go to the parties. I mean, I feel like this movie is strongest when it's self-deprecating, you know, when it is based on being a loser, when it is about being a loser,
yeah,
in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I think that, but, you know, I think that in 2016 terms, Trent comes across much more as like a pickup artist who negs women. And I think that he's still very funny. It's, you know, the iconic Vince Vaughn role.
Sure.
Not just his breakout, but I think it's the one that basically set the tone for his career to come.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a little less charming to see him, I think, in 2016. And I just never liked Mike. I never
no?
did. No, I never liked him that much when he, just like as a hero. Mm-hmm. I think there was like a little too much self-pity to him that I didn't mind as much when watching this, you know, when I was a teenager or in college. But I think now I get a little exasperated by. So still a lot of scenes that I think in this largely episodic movie work really well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as a whole, it just didn't hold up as well for me. But no. How about you, Matt?
I mean, I think I probably enjoyed it a little more than you did. I agree that there's some things that looking back at it, you're sort of, frankly, mortified by. I mean, actually, you mentioned Trent, the pickup artist thing. I didn't quite get that, but I see it now that you say it. To me, though, I was kind of mortified by like how often Mikey is calling women skanks at the beginning
of
the movie.
Yes.
It's like it's not just one time. It's like over and over and over in the first like 15 minutes. And then they don't say it again. But like those first like 15, 20 minutes, he's just saying it all the time. And I obviously in 1996, you know, to my great shame, that didn't really make me bat an eye, but now I'm like, oh my goodness, that's a lot of skank language.
Well, it's a weird thing to also call all of these women because you're
right.
Like, they're not talking to you, they're not sleeping with you.
Right, they didn't
they're
do
not,
anything
yeah.
to him.
Like, what evidence do you have that they are skanks?
Right.
Other than that, they are not the woman that you're still hung up on.
Right.
Who was a real woman.
Right.
Yeah.
So that I thought was pretty mortifying for sure. But I did enjoy it. I think that it is a time capsule. It is of its era. You know, I mean, I'm not trying to say because of that stuff, you shouldn't watch this movie or we should, you know, destroy it. I think that it is, that's almost now kind of what makes it, I think, the most interesting thing is that it feels very much like of its time. It feels like a snapshot of this time at this place, which I think in some ways is valuable, even though I'm kind of horrified by some of that language. There's a little homophobia in the movie, too, which I didn't remember, but there's a lot of that in a lot of movies from that period.
And there still is today.
And there still is today. So, yeah, I don't know. I can't say that I loved it as much as I did when I was 18, but I still kind of liked it. I think it has something. I think if nothing else, you see why Favreau became a star, and even more why Vince Vaughn became a star. And I think it's a very well directed movie for a little movie, which was clearly made on no budget. And I also thought the thing that I never noticed as an 18-year-old that I really appreciate now is the editing in this movie is really wonderful for the sort of comic timing, the transitions between scenes. Steven Murione is the editor. He went on to edit a lot of Soderbergh movies. He did the Oceans trilogy. He did Traffic. He then did a lot of Inarritu movies like Babel. We don't have to talk about that. But they're in the car going to Vegas, which has now, you know, Vegas, baby, Vegas has been, you know, it's like,
yeah,
like so many things in this movie really did become kind of a part of the language. And then they're so excited. And then there's an instant cut to they're still in the car,
potentially
hours
drive.
Later.
Yeah.
And they're like, Vegas, baby, we're going to make like those kind of moments. And there's a bunch of them, including some that are very self-deprecating, as you said, I thought were really, really great.
Yeah, it's funny that the aspect of this movie that would seem to make it the most dated, which is the swing scene, the whole,
yeah.
the aspirations these characters have towards being the Rat Pack when they are, in fact, like broke, aspiring actors.
They're
and comedians.
Losers.
Yes. I mean, that is the part that I don't think feels like it's aged too much, whereas you think it might because that
the language,
was so,
the
it was so
swing
also,
music,
right,
yeah.
confined to this particular moment. But
yep.
I think that it still works well because that contrast between this glamour to which they aspire and the reality of their lives and like their terrible apartments, which is something that I hadn't remembered and really
yes,
appreciated.
Yes, the apartments I
the
noticed
accuracy
as well.
Of like their terrible apartments.
Jon Favreau's apartment is, it might be like a record for awful apartments in movies
yes.
at this period when we're
right.
still like, you think of like the Woody Allen New York apartments where they're like, who lives in an apartment like this when they're like a struggling writer? Here you have Favreau, the struggling comic, and his apartment is so pathetic and sad. It's great.
It is great. Yeah. I think that the thing about this movie that did feel more aged to me is its kind of place on a spectrum of, and maybe as a kind of precursor to these like bro comedies that happened, you know, a decade or so later. Some
the more
which,
mainstream ones,
yes,
you mean,
some
like
of
the Hollywood
which starred
comedies.
Vince Vaughn.
True.
You know?
Oh, like Wedding Crashers
right.
and that kind of thing.
And I think that, you know, it's funny to see this movie, which is so much about like men hanging out, right? And like male friendships and men trying to teach each other how to talk to women.
Yeah.
I think that I mean, that's the part of this that actually feels a bit more dated to me. Not that it's about men, but just something about its bro comedy-ness that feels, I don't know, like it felt like it held together a little less well to me.
That's interesting. I didn't really think of it on that continuum, but I can see it now that you say it. I mean, Vince Vaughn did make a lot of movies like this in Hollywood. And maybe this is like the less kind of mainstream version, or just less broad comedy. Like, you think of those movies he made, like with Will Ferrell, like an old school, where you sort of take this kind of the milieu and you really make it a big broad comedy, where this is a little bit more of a drama or a dramedy, a little more observational, a little more sociological. Yeah, I can see that. The other thing I wanted to mention, I don't know if you felt this way, that kind of shocked me, was I'm not blaming this on Netflix necessarily, but this movie looked really bad to me in terms of the print. Like, I don't know if this is just they need to make a restoration of it or something. But talking about how 1996 doesn't feel that long ago to me, the movie I just thought looked very grainy and low res. It didn't look very good, and I was kind of surprised. You know, I expected for a movie that's not that old to look better, because I've seen movies on Netflix, online, on streaming that are much older that look crisper and cleaner. Maybe this movie needs a little cleanup. I don't know. But the print that Netflix had, I thought was, I mean, it reminded me of watching it on VHS at that period. It just doesn't look that great.
Yeah, I didn't notice, but maybe it's because my associations with this movie are VHS, and that's how it looks in my mind, in my mind's eye, in my memory. But I will say, since we're talking about how it looks, there's something about, like, this movie came in an era of indie movies that were often dialogue-driven and didn't necessarily look that great, you know?
True.
And this movie's, like, cinematic qualities really deserve a shout-out. Mm-hmm. I think Doug Liman is a good director, if not always a consistent one. And you know, beyond just like the moments in which they quote Tarantino and quote Goodfellas, Scorsese multiple times. I think that it doesn't look like the camera has just been plopped somewhere to capture these like witty exchanges.
Right.
You know, there's no Clerksiness to it. And I appreciate that, because it's not necessarily, I mean, oftentimes we're working in places that these characters are in places that are supposed to be dingy. You know, they're terrible apartments. The bar that they go to with Marty and Elaine playing, you know, they are so trying so hard to be cool, and yet are so often in places that are not that cool, or in which they are the least cool part.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the scene where they walk into the Hollywood Hills party and everyone looks for a second as they pose and then goes back. Yeah.
Yeah. You're nobody.
Yes.
Who are you? No, you're not important. Yeah. That's a nice moment. The other thing, you know, you talked about like sort of the bro comedies that followed the sort of maybe influence that I wondered about was kind of on more awkward comedy, things like The Office or Curb Your Enthusiasm. Not that obviously, you know, Larry David was making Seinfeld at this time, but just scenes like the one where Favreau leaves those series of messages, which is so wonderfully uncomfortable, is a really great scene. And that sort of comedy was definitely not quite as in vogue as it would become later. Like, that really feels like something from The Office to me.
Yeah, and I love that scene. And I think the movie is better when it is doing that.
Yes.
You know, and I suppose that's why I feel like the ending of this movie, I've never loved, and it's always soured me a bit. And the part where his girlfriend finally calls.
Okay, I was going to say which ending, because there's sort of two endings.
There's multiple endings. I mean, like, the kind of triumph on the dance floor is a really good moment.
That's a great scene.
Yes.
I love that.
It's just the closing where his girlfriend finally calls, and he's Heather Graham is calling
up
the other line.
The girlfriend.
Yes. And so
she's perfectly saying, like, I love you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a bit of, like, take that.
For sure.
I find, like, that there's, like, this occasional sour note to that I don't like.
Yeah.
Especially when the whole point of this movie is that he moved out to L.A. and his relationship ended because he left her.
Yes.
And that, like, you know, then I don't think, like, being like, oh, finally, you know, you let that terrible girl behind after she tried to move on from you.
Right.
Yeah.
How dare she dump him for leaving her?
Yeah. I think that, as I said, I think this movie is best when it is kind of letting its characters mock themselves.
I completely agree.
It's funny that after allowing, I think, a very earned moment of triumph, it then goes a little too far.
Yeah, I agree. That moment does feel forced, and it doesn't you know, I agree that the best stuff is when we're sort of taking the piss out of these characters.
Right.
And showing the difference between their aspirations for coolness, as you said, and their really pathetic lives. And there is this sort of tendency to sort of want to get revenge in a way, which seems, I don't know, it just seems cheap.
But this movie is in part a movie about a guy getting his groove back, right?
Correct.
About, like, him understanding his money if he doesn't even know it.
Yes.
But the other part of this, and I think it's funny that the movie closes that way, is that it's kind of a movie about, like, when we're powerful, finally, we can treat people like dirt. Like, you know, I feel like this part of, like, in terms of, it's not like, oh, I want to make it in Hollywood in a way. It's like, I will be on top someday.
I want revenge.
Like, that's what I want.
Sense.
I want to be powerful enough to.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
That said, the final scene,
oh,
I mean,
yes.
is in a way, it's almost a reversal of that. I mean, Favreau's character, Mikey, is happy, but it's also like the ultimate embarrassment of Trent,
yes.
which is sort of nice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I like the fact that literally the very last thing is him getting schooled and embarrassed.
Yes. Yes.
And also, you know, the kind of, again, like undercutting of, you know, Favreau knows the secret now to, you know, to life, essentially, and he's about to explain it, and that's when Vince Vaughn's character is, like, distracted by this woman, and we never hear the ultimate message, you know?
Right.
I think that's a nice moment as well.
Yeah, agreed. And I think that their friendship is, I mean, it's certainly the key to this movie, but it's also, there is something really nice to its heart in that way also of like that friendship, those friendships that you have that can be very intense and then like maybe burn out, you know, you don't feel like Mike and Trent you don't know how Mike and Trent met.
No,
you don't. They're not, they didn't know each other like from New York.
Right. They don't, like, doesn't like seem like they knew each other in the past, that like, they're recent friends, but they're
character.
So close.
Right.
I was wondering about that too this time.
And that you have that feeling that maybe they're not going to be friends forever, but it's that moment where you're both in the same place in life that like you can have a really intense friendship with someone.
I agree with everything you've said, especially about that scene, you know, with the phone calls, the two calls at the same time with the old girlfriend. That said, in a way, I almost want to argue that there's something, as much as it's kind of gross, there's something kind of honest about it in a way,
sure.
because this is a movie that, you know, from the mid 90s that a struggling, you know, filmmaker wrote in his mid-20s, I mean, there's probably something truthful about that.
I don't doubt it. I just think it's presented as a triumphant bit.
Completely.
And I feel like I wish this movie had the self-awareness to suggest that, like, that wasn't, there is a sourness to that, know that. And I don't think it does.
Totally, totally fair.
All right, before we close this out, what is your favorite line from this movie?
Well, I'm going to go with a random one just because, besides all the famous lines, there's a line that I say in my life, which I did not remember was from this movie.
And
And it is the line that they say Trent, Vince Vaughn, has that monologue about this horrible audition he went on, which I think is actually based on something that from Vaughn's life.
It feels like it is, yeah.
And there's this awkward pause afterwards, and Favreau says, well, we all have stories. And I say that all the time. When someone tells a story and then no one knows what to say next, I always say, well, we all have stories. And that is from this movie. So I was like, so I chuckled because I had no memory of it being from this.
You internalized it.
I had internalized it, yeah.
I have a fondness for Alex Desire's repeated line, this place is dead anyway.
This place is dead anyway.
Oh,
it's pretty
inevitably
great.
When they're leaving a party that looks amazing
yes.
or a bar that is like packed with people.
Yeah.
Always like on the move to whatever the next scene is.
Yeah. Can I ask one other question
Please.
Before we wrap it up? Did you think at all, ponder the hair of Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn and how little of it they have?
I think that they are two people. It's hard to look at without being like, oh, time. Time has its way, with us all.
Okay. Yeah, that works. No, we can leave it right there. Swingers is available right now on Netflix.
You're nobody till somebody loves you. You're nobody till somebody cares. You may be king, you may possess the world and its gold, but gold won't bring you happiness when you're growing old. The world still is the same, you never change it. as sure as the stars shine above. You're nobody till somebody loves you. So find yourself somebody to love.
All right, let's move on to Q Shots. We're talking about 1996, the year that was. I was 15 for most of the year. My birthday's in December, so I was mostly 15 that year. Guess that would be, I'm trying to think of which years. It was high school. I don't know which years off
sophomore
the top of my
year?
Head. Sophomore into
sophomore
junior?
Year. Yeah.
Something like that. I have open here the Wikipedia page for 1996 in film, and I thought very quickly before we start, I might ask Allison a few questions here.
All right, I'm ready.
You Bring know it. The best film for the Oscars, because we already talked
English
about that.
Patient.
Yes. Do you know the best actor from that year?
Ray Fiennes?
A good guess. I'm sure he was nominated, but no, it was Jeffrey Rush from Shine.
Shine, yes. Yeah.
And how about best actress?
God, I have no idea.
The Coen brothers?
Oh,
Frances McDormand from Fargo. Marge yes, from
Anderson.
Fargo.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. How about the number one box office hit, at least in the... I guess this is worldwide. So worldwide number one box office hit.
Independence Day?
That is correct. How about the number two movie?
I'm at a loss.
Twister.
Oh, Twister was 1996.
Yeah. I remember it well.
Do you? I do not.
When I was 17, it was a very good year. Anyway.
Please don't get nostalgic over Twister.
Sorry. I'm sorry. Cow!
Let's move on.
All right. Well, do you want to go first? You have a 1996 movie you want to talk about?
Sure. Well, looking over this year, mm-hmm. I feel like we have some movies that are very much still in the consciousness.
Oh,
like
absolutely.
Fargo especially, I think, has, especially with a TV show being mm-hmm. made. It's always interesting to me which movies also get acclaimed and talked about and then don't stick, you know?
The English Patient,
like
right?
The English Patient, yeah. Certainly. But I wanted to look at a movie that I got a lot of acclaim, but I think has like been neglected unfairly, really, mm-hmm. Ever since. And Roger Ebert was a big fan of it and championed it. And despite that, I think it's gone neglected. It is Eve's Bayou, which is
yes.
available for rent right now. This was a directorial debut of Casey Lemons, who went on to make a few movies like Talk to Me, Don Cheadle in 2007. She made the Nativity musical, last year or the year before that was not well received. Mm. But this movie was certainly acclaimed and has an amazing cast. It's set in 1962 Louisiana, and the protagonist is a 10-year-old named Eve, played by Journey Smollett, who is the middle child of this well-off family and kind of in this awkward place where she's neither the favorite of her mother, Roz, played by Lynn Whitfield, who kind of prefers her younger brother and dotes on him, or her father, Louis, played by Samuel L. Jackson, who is closest to Cicely, the oldest daughter, played by a young Megan Good. And over the course of a summer, Eve starts to see her father differently, especially after the party with which the movie starts ends with her seeing him cheating on her mother with another woman. But it is really about how all the various women in this family deal with, adore, and hate this man at the same time. He's the town doctor and is also kind of the town star. He's beloved by everyone, seemingly. He mentions multiple times that he needs to and likes to be seen as a hero. And he is not. He's a womanizer. He is highly imperfect. He likes to drink. He likes to stay out. But he is charismatic and bright. And you understand why everyone is almost kind of resentful of how much they want his attention. So that's true for Roz. It's true for Cicely, with whom he has an increasingly complicated relationship that becomes the crux of the movie. And it's true for Eve, who constantly wants his attention, but is also angry at him for both being denied it and for what she sees as these betrayals of her various family members. I mean, this is kind of a noir. It unfolds over this kind of really interesting, like Creole-inflected part of Louisiana, and it's always filmed in this like beautifully like dark, shady, like the whole town is shaded over by these trees with hanging moss, like it's filled with secrets that you can almost see, that are almost visible built into the landscape, and it sets up this great divide between. Samuel L. Jackson's character being this man who represents science, but there's just as equal undercurrent of power that's attached to voodoo and to second sight, with Debbie Morgan playing his sister, Moselle, who's had these terrible run with husbands who've all died tragically, and who caters to this upscale clientele with his second sight, while meanwhile this woman named Elzora, played by Diane Carroll, is the town witch and offers a more kind of immediate form of voodoo. But it's just this kind of roiling set of elements that all come together really nicely in the story towards the end, and that become about a child's point of view and about it changing in a way that I think it kind of beats Atonement at, that it is about understanding that you're not seeing, that you don't understand things, and that the world as you see it and the things you think you know, you can never have certainty with. And it's got some really nice performances, especially Journey Smollett, who's gone on to have like a grown-up career, but is a really good child actor here, and who doesn't play into the cuteness of her character too much, but is also adorable. It's a great movie, and it I think got a lot of good attention, yet it didn't really lead to Casey Lemons having a career that and a lot of other people who had strong debuts in 1996, including the people behind Swingers, went on to have. But it is definitely worth excavating. I think that it holds up very well and seems like a movie from the era that we should talk about more. That is Eve's Bayou. It is available for rent.
All right. That's a great pick. One reason this week is a great week to talk about the films of 1996 is because the biggest movie of 1996, which Allison correctly identified, is getting its first ever sequel next weekend. At least as we're recording this. That movie is, again, Independence Day, directed by Roland Emmerich, and you can currently rent it, or it's also available on HBO Go and HBO Now. And this is the wildly successful blockbuster about an alien invasion of Earth, which is repelled by the combined efforts of the President of the United States, played by Bill Pullman, a dweeby computer wizard, played by Jeff Goldblum, and a cocky and brash Marine Corps pilot, played by Will Smith, in the movie that transformed the Fresh Prince into one of the biggest movie stars in the world. And despite the movie's enormous popularity and enduring popularity, I don't think I had seen Independence Day since maybe 1997. Maybe I saw it more than once, but since that period, I was never a big fan of this movie when it came out. And as it slowly kind of accrued this reputation among people a little younger than us as this kind of 90s classic, I've mostly been very skeptical of that. But because Independence Day Resurgence is about to come out, I wanted to revisit it. This seemed like a good excuse to see, like, how is it as a movie beyond the whole kind of reputation? Is it a classic or is it a disaster of a disaster movie? And I have to say I kind of liked it. I don't think it's sort of in the middle is the short answer. The long answer is that on this viewing, I did really enjoy Jeff Goldblum's very quirky performance. Obviously he's in the new movie, but there's just not enough characters in these kinds of movies these days that are just sort of like genuinely kind of nebbishy and weird and not like physically heroic at all. There's too many like nerds that are also like actual like physical superheroes, whereas his character is like, he's a legitimate nerd. He's an actual nerd, which I appreciated. And Bill Pullman is very good as the president. He gives that great speech, which has, sort of become rightfully famous, I think. And, the effects, which were so groundbreaking at the time, literally, metaphorically, they really hold up very well. I think when the aliens attack, you know, the White House, the Empire State Building, the Capitol Building in L.A., because apparently aliens hate the music industry, Allison. There are some very, I would say, genuinely terrifying, genuinely nightmarish images in that sequence. That's a very powerful sequence. On the flip side, I did not remember how much horrible comic relief there is in this movie. Harvey Fierstein and Judd Hirsch and Harry Connick Jr., on top of Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum, who are also constantly making terrible jokes. And I don't know when the last time you saw this movie was, Allison, but, you know, while the sort of the big effects and the ships and the explosions, they're all great, the aliens themselves might be some of the worst aliens who have ever been in, like, a movie this big. They don't look real at all. They look like puppets that aren't even being puppeted. They look like inanimate objects, which is, it really, whenever we see the actual aliens, I think it really brings the whole movie down. And the whole plot about they give the aliens a computer virus, I mean, given the fact that I can't make my Kindle and my iPhone talk to one another, the fact that Jeff Goldblum can give the aliens a computer virus is pretty silly. But it was, I actually found it pretty fascinating to look back at this movie, because I think in the wake of it, a lot of things, you know, it was a very influential movie. But like in so many cases, Hollywood looks at something successful and they take the wrong thing from it. Like, which in this case was, well, okay, well, we need bigger explosions. We need the whole world to be at stake. We need incredible special effects. And the effects in Independence Day are very impressive, and they do hold up well. But there is some nice character stuff here, and you do, like, care about the people, which is something that I feel like is the lesson that not enough movies took. Like, we actually, as goofy as Jeff Goldblum is, we actually care about him and his dad. They have some sweet scenes together. And Will Smith and Vivica A. Fox have a very nice relationship. And the president and his daughter and the first lady. There's actual characters here. It's not just about the action. And you feel things. And it's like, I feel like the movies that came out of this, too many of them they nail the spectacle, but they don't capture the emotions, which is the reason that this movie, I think, even more than the effects, is why it became so famous. Now, for the sequel, I don't know. They haven't shown it to any critics. It's about to open, which is not a good sign. But I think the original movie, it held up better than I expected to. I will give it that. And it's worth a watch at least once. And that is Independence Day, and you can rent it. And it is also available on HBO Go and HBO Now.
Yeah, I haven't seen that movie since it was in theaters.
Yeah.
I think I ended up seeing it twice when it was in theaters. I enjoyed it thoroughly, but I don't understand the nostalgia for it. I think it has never seemed like a movie that has been screaming for a sequel.
No, certainly not. I think if there's a reason to be nostalgic for it, it is the effects. Because, there's obviously some digital stuff going on there, but there is a, like, when those buildings are being destroyed by the aliens, there's something visceral and tangible about that. And even some of the, people running through cities for their lives, sure, it was probably shot on a back lot, but it wasn't like a green screen. I think I've seen so many movies lately where I feel like I'm watching a cartoon that a real person is standing in front of.
Yeah, well, beyond that, I feel like so many movies I see these days, when there are people like running through the streets, it's just obviously like a digital crowd.
You know?
It doesn't look like a group of people. It looks like like one of the box of effects that's been clicked on.
I think it was very easy to buy into this movie, to believe that what you were seeing was real.
I do enjoy the thought of aliens debating over what's the major landmark of L.A., though.
Right.
To be like, where? It's so, like, it's such a sprawl.
Look how much money the music industry makes. We must destroy it. There would be a little different.
They didn't
different.
Aim for, like, the Walk of Stars or anything like that.
No.
They're, like, Capitol Buildings where it's at.
Yeah.
All right, well, for my next movie, I picked a movie that that Hollywood has been trying to remake for a while now, and actually one that I think could potentially do well with a remake. It is The Craft, which is available for streaming on Amazon Prime, directed by Andrew Fleming and starring Robin Tunney, Fairuza Balk, Neve Campbell, and Rachel True as a set of four young women in high school who become a coven and discover that with great power comes great responsibility. This movie is, I think, like, very much of its era in some ways, and it's undeniably hokey at times. It from the opening credits, which are just extremely 90s in some terrible ways. That said, there is a kind of weight to the fundamental idea of it that the movie, I think, like, manages to find and to make use of, even despite the cheesiness of the way it's done, which is that it's a group of outcasts, like school outcasts, who basically are given this way to take back their own power. You know, when you have Rochelle, Rachel True's character, who's being bullied and called like racist slurs by the pretty blonde girl in school, and then gets to have her revenge by basically making the girl's hair fall out. And she's played by Christine Taylor, by the way. You know, or you have Bonnie, Nev Campbell's character, who's been like scarred since childhood and has been just like withdrawn and always covers herself up and gets mocked a lot because of that. And then with their power is able to kind of like wish herself into being healed. Or Fareeza Balk's character, Nancy, who is the villain of the story, is, you know, comes from the worst background, has like the terrible home life, and basically uses, like, if power is like the secret, she like wills her stepfather to die and leave them money, and she and her mother are able to like move on to this better life. I think there is something to this like wish fulfillment, you know, given to these outcast girls, that despite the movie's gothiness circa, you know, via Hot Topic, which is definitely its aesthetic, I think works really well, you know, especially with also a main character who, you know, is coming off a suicide attempt and who almost gets bullied into another one. The movie's strengths are really in its character work, in how it is about people who have been suffering at the hands of a high school, you know, the social gauntlet, and who find this way to get back in some way, to get back at them. And I think that those are the ways, and actually, like, rewatching it, it reminded me a lot of Chronicle. I think that Chronicle pulls pretty heavily from this on the same ways, instead with like a much more like guy version of this, by being like, have some superpowers, you know, group of teenage boys, and maybe you're not going to use them all for the best things, and maybe one of you who comes from the worst background is going to misuse these powers terribly. But I think that like it tells the same story just from this more feminine perspective. Do I think this is a good movie? No. Do I think that it gets looked at with a haze of nostalgia? That is, yes, absolutely. But I think that it does a lot of things right in its central conceit. And I don't think that that should be just blown off. You know, I think as much as plenty of movies get elevated into new classic just on the basis of people having watched them as a teenager, or finding some, or having discovered them later, but, you know, and attaching all this glaze of nostalgia to something, I do think that actually the central idea of this would work well being remade. They keep trying to, and have attached different directors. I think Corin Hardy, who did The Hallow, was the latest one to be attached and then drop out. But I would like to see it actually dragged into the new era, and like to actually deal with bullying in the current age, because I think there is still something there that could work. So it is definitely worth another look. The Craft, it is streaming on Amazon Prime.
I will confess, I have never seen The Craft.
You were sitting there smirking at me this whole time.
I've been listening intently.
I'm shocked.
Never seen it. But now having a daughter, I feel like it's only a matter of time where there's, you know, in a few years down the line, I'll be watching it, probably.
Yeah, well,
it may not become a treasured text because there's no nostalgia there, but feels like it's something she's going to find at some point.
There, I mean, there really are, especially, I didn't even mention this, but like the main character played by Robin Tunney has this storyline in which she's a new girl at school and goes out with the football player played by Skeet Ulrich.
Ooh.
90s own Skeet Ulrich.
Sure.
And then he tells everyone the day after that she had sex with him.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, you know, slut shamed by the whole school.
Mm.
And like that she has revenge on him by casting a love spell on him, in which she basically just regains all power. And of course, it doesn't always go well. But everyone's spells go wrong at the end. But I think that there is something to that idea that has a lot of potential to it dramatically.
Mm.
So,
Well, it's interesting listening to you talk about this movie and also thinking more about Independence Day. You know, so many of these movies that have become kind of, I don't want to say cult films because they're mainstream movies, but have accrued this nostalgic kind of love. I wonder how much of it has to do with, you know, just that they're just on all the time.
Well, certainly, you know, and I think things have been written about this. The, like, 20-something kind of, like, fan base for Friends, a show that was, for some people, not even on.
Not
like,
on you when were, they were. When they were, right. Yeah. Originally.
Yes. That they were just, like, much too young for.
Right.
I mean, I'm not, I feel like nostalgia is the wrong word for it. When you didn't experience it for the first time, you're not looking back on it.
Right.
I'm not sure, like, why some of these properties, and, like, why those particular properties are the ones that kind of accrue this following.
What I was going to say, though, what I was curious about is this going to change? Because, like, there were movies that we watched on cable that were just, mostly because they were available. We didn't have Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and thousands of movies to choose from at any moment. We had, you know, 30 channels and whatever was playing, you know what I mean? And I wonder if there's going to be less of those sorts of things when you can pick whatever you want to watch and there aren't those common movies that, oh, you know, Congo was on HBO 6,000 times when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like, I could recite Congo, like, line for line, and that's a terrible movie.
Yeah, it is a terrible movie.
No one would choose to watch Congo.
No, I think that, I think that we are, like, the dominance, the incomprehensible to me, dominance of, like, Friends.
Speaks to that.
I think, yeah, that it still works. You know, how do a lot of people find Friends? They found it because the box sets were available, and now it's streaming.
It's on TV
it's
all
on
the
Netflix.
Time. Yeah.
But, like, I think that what is fascinating to me, and still something I have trouble contending with, is, like, what movies people pick from various eras to fixate on, and why those are the ones that stick.
I'm very curious to see what, you know, what the Netflix generation sort of fixates on. That's going to be interesting. All right. Well, I couldn't really decide what other movie to do with my last pick. I thought about Primal Fear, which was a movie that was, like, on HBO a million times also.
And the movie that launched Ed Norton's career.
That's right. That is available on Netflix.
It is a giant audition tape for Edward Norton.
Pretty much. It's a showcase for him, but he's great in it. That is available on Netflix. There's Star Trek First Contact, which is also on Netflix. That's a very good Star Trek movie. Escape from LA is on Netflix. Good, but not as good as Escape from New York. I like Disney's Hunchback of Notre Dame, or at least I did at the time, and I was kind of curious about revisiting that, kind of an underrated Disney Renaissance movie. I didn't have time to, though. I also thought about Scream. The original Scream is now 20 years old, which blew my mind. That is on HBO Go and HBO Now. But, of course, I decided not to watch any of those. I decided to almost give myself, like, a secondary theme, like, with Independence Day, which was 96 pop culture that is, like, back in culture now. So the other thing that I thought of was Mystery Science Theater 3000, because they're doing this big reunion with all of the original, or most of the original cast. There's a whole new version of the show, which Joel Hodgson, the original creator and star, is about to launch with a new cast and new writers. I'm sure it's going to be called MST3K Resurgence. So I thought it might be interesting because MST3K is another thing that I watched a lot as a kid. You know, it was like in the trinity of TV shows that defined my teenage years, along with Seinfeld and The Simpsons. And for a long time, because it was on and then I would have the tapes or whatever, I would watch it all the time. But now in this age of Netflix and Hulu, I don't watch it as much. And so I thought it would be interesting to watch something from 1996. That was the year the movie came out. And it was the year of the seventh season of the show. So there's only one episode from the seventh season that's available online right now. It's called The Brute Man. You can watch that on Hulu and also on Shout Factory TV. And arguably, even though the show was never a huge mainstream hit, I think looking at it now that I've always felt it was influential, but it only seems more influential to me now. And watching the Brute Man episode last night, I really saw YouTube culture in it. You know, that YouTube is not so much about creating content as it is critiquing other content and turning that into your creation. You know, it's about filming yourself playing a video game and talking over it. It's about making an honest trailer of a movie and making fun of it, you know? And so I kind of expected the show to look kind of dated, and it, in a weird way, it doesn't. In a weird way, it feels timeless. The movies are very old. The hosted segments are quasi-futuristic. And so it doesn't really feel like it's from the 90s. It could have been made at any time. And the fact that in the host segments, all the characters are talking to the camera also kind of makes it feel like a YouTube show. Like they're like selfies almost in a weird way. And so it's a fascinating show to watch because you get like immediately I go, oh, this is why the show continues to be popular in a way, is that it still speaks to a lot of the things that are still going on. And you know, the Brute Man episode, not one of my favorites. I had actually never seen this one before. It's not a show that I've seen every single episode. But I think you get in that episode, like so many others, just the density of jokes, which is another thing that I feel like so many people copied, which is just if you have a million jokes, only half of them or even a quarter of them have to be funny. And then your show is or your movie is funny. And I'm very curious to see what the new show looks like. Like, is it going to look just like the old one? Or are they going to do something different? I'm very curious about that. But I think the old show still looks really good, and it still, in a weird way, is kind of, even though it's like a puppet show, which is insane, it still looks surprisingly relevant and funny. Even though some of the jokes are dated, the general premise, in a weird way, feels more timely now than it maybe did in 1996, which is pretty interesting. So I guess people don't need me to recommend Mystery Science Theater 3000, but I was interested in kind of dwelling on it as a thing and considering how it holds up today. And if you haven't watched it in a while, it's interesting to look at it now as a product of its era that works surprisingly well in 2016. So that's MST3K. There's a lot of episodes available on Hulu and Shout Factory TV. All right, Allison, what time is it? It's time for silence. Is that angry stares? You're just not going to answer? No, just shake your head. She's shaking her head. People can't see you doing that. I'm just going to narrate what you're doing then. Shaking your head.
Podcast magic right here.
Let's talk about some new movies, shall we? As I mentioned, Independence Day, one of the biggest movies of the year, has not screened.
It's screening on Friday morning,
which is technically now after it comes out because movies now come out on Thursdays.
It definitely is. Like, yeah. The first public screenings will be at 8 o'clock
or earlier
on Thursday night.
So they're essentially saying, don't see it that night. Not a good sign.
No.
So we haven't seen that.
I haven't seen The Shallows.
Oh,
but
you
it
have
is embargoed.
Oh, okay.
So I can't
we can't talk about
it.
That. Yeah, I'm seeing that next week. Okay. Well, you'll tell me off the air how that is. But let's talk about the stuff that is in theaters right now, including another one of the biggest movies of the year, for sure. The Pixar movie of this summer, Finding Dory, the sequel to Finding Nemo. I haven't read your review. I don't know what you thought of it, Allison. Did you enjoy it?
I liked it. I don't think it is as good as Finding Nemo, but I think that it works really well. And for a movie that revisits the same structure and really revisits the same theme of kind of learning to let someone go, like let someone make their own way, I think there's actually something kind of a little pointed about applying that same theme to Dory, who is, unlike Nemo, not a child, you know, is this kind of adult with this memory problem. It develops a little bit of an edge, I think, in being like, it's not always going to go well. She's not always going to do well, but she deserves to be trusted to try things herself. Mm-hmm. You know? And I think the movie actually presented that really well and also worked well in lodging itself in the experiences of a character who's a funny sidekick in the first movie, but who can be, I think, by design, a frustrating main character.
Yes.
She gets, you know, she gets distracted very easily. She makes some very poor choices. And I think in this, scenes that are genuinely upsetting, comes close to forgetting what she was doing and, like, basically forgetting all of the other parts of the movie, you know? And I think the movie handled that really well with a character who I think has a lot of potential to be annoying. I think it allowed
comes very
her,
close.
And allowed her to be a bit annoying,
yes.
You know? And yeah. I think that it did that well. And also, the octopus is great.
Also, the octopus is awesome. Yeah, I interviewed Andrew Stanton, and we talked a little bit about this and how in the first movie she says that being forgetful runs in her family, or so she thinks, and that
where are they?
Right.
Yeah.
And they originally took that as the truth and tried to write the parents as forgetful and said that that was a major mistake because one forgetful character is can be annoying. Three forgetful characters will literally like drive you to the point of madness and frustration. And yeah, I pretty much in a complete agreement with you. It's not as good as Finding Nemo, which is one of my very favorite, if not my single favorite Pixar movie. And it does kind of, you know, the best stuff about it is kind of the best stuff about the first movie. They didn't make it that different. And, you know, I felt like the movie went on a little too long. I thought the last sort of big set piece didn't work at all for me.
Oh, I liked it.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, I was like, this movie should be over already. This is kind of terrible. But before that, I did enjoy it. I think it's a very well made, you know, Pixar, they know what they're doing and they do it very well. And
but not always. They're coming off a loss, as you say.
Yeah,
you know,
I suppose.
Like a dinosaur.
They have a formula and it works. I would say the issue might be that it is feeling more and more formulaic as time goes on. They may need to start to, I don't know. I guess they have hit on this thing that works, and sometimes it works incredibly well, but it just sometimes it does feel, especially when you're making a sequel where you've got the same characters, the same milieu, it does begin to feel like it's just a little bit paint by numbers. Beautiful paint, incredible numbers, but it just does feel a little familiar. But still, I had a good time. I enjoyed it. Very quickly, there's one other big movie in theaters, Central Intelligence. The Rock and Kevin Hart. And I know, actually, we did discuss this one after it was over, so I know what you think. But why don't you tell people, would you encourage people to see this film if perhaps Finding Dory is sold out or they're not in the mood for talking fish?
I mean, I feel like it just works. Mm. You know, it's a pretty sloppy comedy. It spends too much time with action that is not that well shot.
It's bad. The action is bad.
And a whole spy storyline that doesn't make any sense and is also, frankly, not very interesting.
Nope.
But it does have this whole reunion, what am I doing with my life storyline, and it has a great performance from The Rock, who is, it's a really good role for The Rock, actually.
Yep.
It understands that part of what is so enjoyable about his screen presence is this feeling that he, well, being this ridiculous, like, physical presence, doesn't have any of the same, the macho-ness is only cartoonish. It's harmless. You know, it's friendly. He mm-hmm. is this ray of sunshine in
a
muscle man's body. He is a unicorn. He is a dork. I mean, his character is like a big geek and
right.
stays that way. Is an oddball in really charming ways. I think that he's the reason this movie, he's the reason to see this movie. If you like The Rock, and who doesn't like The Rock? That performance is one that like pulls from a lot of his strengths. I mean, like, otherwise, and Kevin Hart's fine. He gets cast as the straight man, which isn't, I think, a role that he really wanted to play. I feel like sometimes he's just busting out of that to seize any opportunity.
He's fighting against it.
Yeah.
He's trying to get some jokes in. Yeah, I agree. But they're good together. That's the thing,
they
make a good combination. They look good together. Like, physically, they're just funny looking together. You know, the very, very short guy and the guy who, you know, like, to me, it was like looking at Bruce Banner and the Incredible Hulk, like, on the screen at the same time. They, you know, like, the character that The Rock is playing is almost like the manifestation of this id that is trying to burst out of Kevin Hart, who's this very frustrated guy whose life has not worked out the way he's wanted it to, even though he's, you know, happily married, kind of. That's another angle of the movie that doesn't entirely
not
work.
Special.
Right.
That
it's boring.
Is the problem.
It's boring.
Yeah. He was exceptional in high school.
Right.
And
he was most likely to succeed, and he's now an accountant.
A normal adult. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. Again, we're this week we are pretty much entirely in agreement. It's not a great movie, but I enjoyed it enough to say, yeah, it's pretty good. I don't think you need to rush out to the theater to see this one. But this is a movie that would have played a million times on cable when we were kids, and then 20 years later we would have been like, oh yeah, Central Intelligence. I saw that movie a million times and it wasn't amazing, but I liked it. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
And The Rock is fantastic.
He is fantastic.
And, you know, I don't know. I don't need to see a Central Intelligence 2, but I would like to see another movie with Kevin Hart and Dwayne Johnson. I think they're a very good pair, and I would be interested to see them make more movies together. All right. Let's do Behind the 8-Ball now. That's how we wrap up the show. Every time we give you some new releases that are on streaming, we give you some listener recommendations that you guys sent to us at our email address, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. And we give you a film chosen blindly by number from our My Lists on Netflix. Allison, who's going first this time?
I'm going first.
All right. So how about you give us three new releases?
Okay. First up, new to Tubi TV is Dark Horse. Todd Solondz's new movie, Wiener Dog, is coming out in theaters, I believe, this week. So you can catch up with his last one on Tubi TV. It is, I think, one of his best, about a man named Abe, played by Jordan Gelber, who is a 30-something loser who has been kind of coddled by his parents, still lives at home with them, collects toys, seems frozen in this man-child territory in the most uncute, like, unlike Will Ferrell comedy way, and tries to court a character played by Selma Blair, who is maybe the grown-up version of the character she played in Storytelling. And things go about as poorly as they often do in a Todd Solondz movie. This movie is so darkly funny and has empathy for a character who is quite fairly terrible. It is definitely worth checking out. That is Dark Horse on Tubi TV. New to Amazon Prime is Mr. Robot, one of the most talked about new shows of last year for good reason, starring Rami Malek as Elliot Alderson, a hacker and
a robot.
But where is Mrs. Robot? Searching for Mrs. Robot. No, he is a hacker, and he is maybe trying to save the world by way of
being a robot,
by way of hacking the credit record a la Fight Club. And this show does like owe a bit to Fight Club, but I think
robot
what
Fight Club
makes it most interesting is the cinematography, which is really distinctive for a television show and is more visual than I think TV usually gets to. Is really a sign of the more cinematic direction that television's taking. So that is Mr. Robot. And finally, new to Fandor is Spider Baby, the 1968 horror comedy written and directed by Jack Hill, starring Lon Chaney Jr. as a caretaker of three wealthy, inbred, nuts siblings who all have their own terrible, weird quirks. Most distinctively, Jill Banner as Virginia, aka the spider baby of the title, who is obsessed with spiders, eats them, and tries to catch people in her web and kill them. It's a very odd movie, and it's a hard to forget one. And that is on Fandor.
All right. How about two listener recommendations?
Okay. First up, we have one from Jorge from Taipei, Vancouver, and Mexico. It's quite a trio. Who writes, the list of TV shows that you presented as listener choice option, this is back a few episodes ago, was disappointing. Aside from the Louis C.K. option, has any of these shows had any cultural impact whatsoever? Will they? Are they remarkable in any way? What I'm getting at is, how come you haven't talked about Les Revenants, or I think it's called here, The Returned, which is available on Netflix? One of the best shows in TV history is not worth talking about just because it's not in English? Let's pretend the English remake never happened. The only plausible explanation for the omission that I can think of is that you haven't seen it. If that's the case, go do yourself a favor and watch the first couple of episodes. Season 2 only gets better. And he also says that he hopes we talk about The Rock for 1996 movies, the last legitimately good Michael Bay movie. I will say, I have talked about The Returned, I believe, like I mentioned it back when it first got put on Netflix.
Yeah,
I've seen the first season. I think it's very good. I have not seen the second season yet. And Pain and Gain is Michael Bay's last legitimately good movie. Bite your tongue, sir. All right. And then we have a comment from Samantha in Fresno who writes, wanted to recommend The Adderall Diaries, which has just been added to Amazon Prime, an adaptation of Stephen Elliott's true crime memoir with James Franco, actually pretty compelling as Elliott, a writer who gets confronted with evidence of fictionalizing his troubled past to make it more dark when his father, played by Ed Harris, shows up at one of his readings. That is The Adderall Diaries, and that is on Amazon Prime.
All right, and one film chosen blindly by a number from your My List.
You gave me number 5.
Robot
it is
My List.
The God of Cookery, Stephen Chow movie that I have not seen. Actually, a 1996 movie. So, fits in with our theme. Stephen Chow stars in it as the most renowned and feared chef in the world who loses his title of the God of Cookery because of his terrible attitude and has to set out to reclaim it. I've never seen it, and I really like Stephen Chow, so that is on my list. Okay, Matt, are you ready?
Yes.
All right, give me three new releases.
First up, Orange is the New Black is back for a fourth season on Netflix. This is probably my favorite Netflix series, I think, in the, you know, all told. I've probably, I guess other than House of Cards, there's no comparison in terms of just the sheer number of episodes I've watched. It's created by Jenji Cohen, based on the book by Piper Kerman. Taylor Schilling once again stars as Piper Chapman, a little fictionalized version there of Piper, the real Piper. And in this women's prison drama, which is always growing more crowded, more complicated, and more dangerous, we discuss seasons 1 and 2 of this show on FilmSpotting SVU episodes 40 and 62. Next up, a timely addition to Netflix, given its subject's recent passing. It's The Trials of Muhammad Ali, a 2013 documentary about Ali's fight to overturn his prison sentence after he refused to be drafted into the Vietnam War because of his religious beliefs. There are a lot of very good movies about Muhammad Ali, and I don't think this is in the upper echelon, but it does focus on an aspect of his life that is very important and is often overlooked or maybe minimized because in most of the other films, they're all about boxing. And during this period, Ali didn't box because he couldn't box. So it's sort of an important movie in that sense, and it's worth checking out if you've seen other Ali docs, but not this one and don't know too much about this time in his life. So that's The Trials of Muhammad Ali, and that is available on Netflix. Finally, coming to Netflix on June 22nd is Spotlight, last year's Oscar Best Picture winner. Directed by Tom McCarthy, the film follows the members of the Boston Globe's investigative unit, Spotlight, as they uncover this cover-up within the Catholic Church. Michael Keaton, Mark Ruffalo, Rachel McAdams star. It was a movie I really enjoyed. Wrote several pieces kind of about how great this movie is. And if you missed it in theaters, if you missed it on home video, it will be on Netflix starting on June 22nd.
All right, two listener recommendations.
Our first comes from Jill, who writes, I'm on a biodoc kick this week, Tab Hunter Confidential, which was produced on a budget and wasn't fancy, but I was totally into it. I love anything about weird Hollywood of yore. Also, Janice, Little Girl Blue, a better, deeper, and sadder film. Next up for me, What Happened, Miss Simone? And that is from Jill. What Happened, Miss Simone, I thought was pretty good as well. I've seen that one. And next up, we have an email from Michael Roche, who writes, Hi, Matt and Allison. I wanted to suggest a short film that's been getting some attention lately, Sunspring, the 9-minute film directed by Oscar Sharp and written by the artificially intelligent computer Jetson, which went on to change its own name to Benjamin because, of course, it did. With little to guide the computer except a database of classic sci-fi movie scripts, Sunspring stars Silicon Valley's Thomas Middleditch and was made in only 48 hours. The actors made an impressive effort at trying to achieve the Herculean task of making Benjamin's total nonsense word salad dialogue work, while Sharp interpreted the AI's completely impossible stage directions. For example, he is standing in the stars and sitting on the floor. And actress Elizabeth Gray ends the film on a monologue that is equal parts incomprehensible, confounding, heartbreaking, and sublime. Sunspring is available for streaming on YouTube. Thanks, guys, and keep up the great work. That's from Michael Roche. And I hadn't heard anything about this. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I saw it bouncing around on Twitter. I didn't have a chance to watch it yet, but that's a pretty good pitch, so I will check it out.
Okay.
All right, and one from your My List.
You gave me number 4, and right now on My List, number 4 is The Burbs from Joe Dante, starring Tom Hanks, film about suburban satire and paranoia, another movie from our childhoods that was on television a lot, but one that I didn't watch that much, but maybe because it was on TV so much or because it actually is really good, has become more and more of a movie people tend to like and look back on fondly. And because I hadn't seen it in so long and never was a huge fan of it, I kind of wanted to revisit it. And that's why I added it to my list. Allison, on this show, or I guess on our last show when we gave our listeners choice options for this show, we went with a theme of 1996. And this time we have a theme, too. It's recent documentaries. We're doing a recent documentary trio of picks. You have the first one. What is it?
I do. It is a documentary called Terror, though as it's written, it's the T in brackets. So
T-error,
yeah. That will be added to Netflix on June 30th. And I think this was a slept-on documentary from last year. It had some big fans among the critics, but it really, I think, should have been a bigger deal. It is directed by Lyric Cabral and David Sutcliffe and is about a live FBI undercover operation in which an informant, like a guy who basically is paid by the FBI on occasion to go and attempt to befriend and inform suspected terrorists, who was Lyric Cabral's downstairs neighbor. That's how she met him. He engages in this sting to try and take down a white Muslim man in, I think he's in Pennsylvania, who goes by this name of Khalifa. And it's all about the incredible clumsiness of how this is done. And also about, it's kind of shocking. And I think the more, especially right now in the news where we're seeing so much about how the FBI did or didn't investigate the Orlando shooter, this is how the FBI investigates a suspected terrorist. And I think that it's kind of shocking and funny and terrible and dark from all angles. So it's a really provocative movie, and it's, I think, a look into how something happens that is startling. So that's Terror. It is on Netflix on June 30th.
All right. I haven't seen that one yet, but I've really been looking forward to it. So I'm excited as that is an option. I would be very happy if that won. I have seen our second choice. It is an even more recent documentary. It is called OJ Made in America, and this is just airing now on television on ESPN and ABC, and it's like a five-part documentary miniseries. If you have cable, you can stream it online. You can watch the whole thing through ESPN's streaming site. If you don't have it, you can buy the whole show, all five episodes, all, I believe, 7.5 hours on iTunes. They're available all over the place, and it is an incredible documentary. It's directed by Ezra Edelman. This is part of the 30 for 30 series that ESPN does, whereas those are usually pretty short, like an hour long. This is 7.5 hours, and even if you know the story, even if you watched the recent OJ series on FX, this shows the whole thing in a new light. There are revelations I certainly didn't know. There are things you see that you've never seen before that are fascinating, very troubling. You see the crime scene photos, which are horrifying. And you don't even really get into the murder and the trial until the third episode, after 3 hours. They spend 3 hours building up not just O.J. Simpson, the man, the celebrity, but also talking about Los Angeles and race and all of these issues that became – that all came together in this trial and influenced what happened during that trial. And I thought it was an incredible, not to spoil the review, but I thought it's a pretty incredible documentary. Allison hasn't seen it yet.
Yeah, and I've been dying to. So
you would be giving her an excuse to watch it, to talk about it. And I don't know, maybe we could do 30 for 30s as a theme even. Yeah. There are a ton of them available on Netflix. They've made some very good ones. So that might be interesting, or sports docs, maybe more broadly, we could do as a possible theme. So that's option number two, OJ Made in America. You can buy it online, or you can stream it on ESPN.
All right, and our third option is a movie-centric doc. It is Raiders, the story of the greatest fan film ever made, which is now available for rent and, I believe, on demand, and is about the making of Raiders of the Lost Ark, the adaptation, which is really one of the most famous fan films ever made. It was made by three teenagers in Mississippi who did a shot-by-shot remake of the Spielberg film. It took them 7 years, so in some scenes they are very young, and in other scenes they are teenagers. And sometimes they pull off some really impressive bits of recreation for a movie that is very special effects heavy. It is an extremely sweet, lovely bit of fan art, like very extensive bit of fan art, and this is a documentary about it. It's kind of a love letter to fan creations like that. So that is our third pick. Raiders, the story of the greatest fan film ever made. That is available for rent.
All right. Which documentary should we review on the next episode of FilmSpotting SVU? You can send your pick to SVU at FilmSpottingSVU.com, or you can enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at FilmSpottingSVU.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, June 27th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu, and you will have all that week to watch the doc we pick. And then join us for our next conversation, which will be around Tuesday, July 5th.
FilmspottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, and we always put up a list of direct links to all of the movies and the TV shows we discuss on the show, so you can find that there as well. The Filmspotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can find more of his work at vincevandal.bandcamp.com. And we will be back in 2 weeks with more recommendations and the documentary review that you pick. And in the meantime, you can always follow us on Twitter. I'm at Allison Wilmore, and Matt is at Matt Singer. And you can follow the show at Filmspotting SVU. That is where we announce the winner of each episode's Listener's Choice and where we share more streaming suggestions that you should know about. For Filmspotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.